This is edition number 1996 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday, the 5th of December, 2025. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 4th of December, 2025. My name is Imogen Waterson and my fellow readers are...
Adrian Allenby,
Merlin Waterson
and Lorna Wilson.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise at around 10 to 8 and will set at around 20 to 4. And we would like to remind all our listeners that the Mardler has a safeguarding policy which is reviewed annually. The purpose of this policy is to meet the statutory requirements for adults at risk, ensure we work closely with Norfolk County Council regarding their well-being, and to ensure that volunteers and listeners are aware of our policy in this area. A copy of our safeguarding policy is available on our website and can be made available in audio format via our listener liaison officer on 01263 587 610.
Later in the programme, the magazine supplement will include stories about an unexpected painting sale and a return to a festive book corner.
But we first turn to the main news items, which include a mystery surrounding a death in North Walsham, an accountant who swindled £70,000 from local churches, the discovery of a drug seller on the dark web, and an unresolved heist at a stately Georgian home. Let's begin with those lead stories.
Mystery still surrounds the passing of Norfolk's Victor Meldrew, who was found dead at his home earlier this year. The inquest of Richard Keeble of Bank Loke in North Walsham heard the 61-year-old had been found unresponsive at his home on June the 27th. Police made the discovery by visiting his home after he had not been heard from for 4 weeks. He was found on the floor of his living room and was declared dead at the scene. Last year, the retired window cleaner was banned from shops in North Walsham after becoming abusive towards staff, which he blamed on his hatred of queuing. Pleading guilty to breaching a community notice, Mr. Keeble described himself to magistrates as being a cross between Victor Meldrew and Alf Garnett. During this month's hearing at Norfolk Coroner's Court, his GP outlined a history of anxiety, depression and poor mental health. He was also facing homelessness, which caused him considerable concern. Before his life in Norfolk, he had previously lived on the streets for more than 10 years. His sister, Donna Richardson, described to the court how her brother had been like a lost soul over the past few years and was like a little boy in a man's body. She said, "I feel he had mental health issues all his life that have not been recognised or addressed. I feel the correct support was not given." Area coroner Johanna Thompson confirmed that the medical cause of his death was unascertained following a post-mortem examination. She said, "The evidence is very scant as to what happened those final days leading up to Richard being found, but clearly concerns were raised for his welfare." She recorded an open conclusion due to lack of evidence.
A treasurer who was jailed for embezzling thousands of pounds from two Norfolk churches died following an unexpected choking incident. Derek Klein, 70, passed away during the early hours of May the 16th last year at the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital, NNN. A recent inquest held at Norfolk Coroner's Court heard he had been in frail health with end-stage renal failure caused by long-term poor management of diabetes. The hearing heard that on May the 15th, a visiting community nurse found Mr. Klein unwell at home, shivering and feverish. Paramedics were called, and he was taken to the NNN, where he was diagnosed with sepsis and acute kidney injury. Doctors began treatment, including intravenous antibiotics. However, at around 11:30 p.m, Mr. Klein was found unresponsive, surrounded by food debris and crumbs, around 10 minutes after eating. Clinicians at the NNN believed he had suffered a sudden aspiration event that caused severe hypoxia, respiratory arrest, and then cardiac arrest. Despite multiple attempts to revive him, he was declared dead at 1:25 a.m. on May the 16th. She noted that he had been given appropriate and necessary care during his admission. The court confirmed his occupation as retired accountant and husband of Rosemary Ann Klein, a housewife. Derek Klein is best known for a dramatic fraud case that made national headlines. In 2007, he was jailed for swindling £70,000 from two parochial church councils over more than two decades to bankroll his twin addictions, stamp collecting and online gambling. The self-employed accountant siphoned £57,000 from Bacton PCC between 1984 and 2007 and another £13,000 from Ridlington PCC from 1993 onwards. The money had been raised through parish fetes, fundraising events, donations and church grants. He kept his offending hidden through a long-running web of lies, even claiming at one point that the funds were safely stored in a high-interest account in Jersey. His actions came to light only after the then-priest in charge, the Reverend Dr. Richard Hines, became suspicious, prompting a police investigation. Officers uncovered not only the missing funds, but also heavy losses from internet gambling, an estimated £350,000, of which he won back only 10%. One of his online usernames was reportedly the Bishop. At the time of his conviction, Mr. Klein had risen to become one of Britain's top five stamp dealers. He had built a vast personal collection of around 100,000 first day covers, weighing 3 tons and filling an entire garage. Among them were valuable issues marking England's 1966 World Club victory, several with Alf Ramsey's signatures, as well as commemorative collections from the reigns of George V and George VI. Presenters sought to seize some and sell the collection in bulk, but Mr. Klein successfully argued it would fetch far more if sold gradually online. Judge Peter Jacobs agreed, a decision that faced criticism, but ultimately allowed the churches to be fully repaid. In April 2013, on the very day Judge Jacobs retired, Mr. Klein made his final repayment of £6,600, settling the entire £70,000 debt. Mr. Klein always protested his innocence, saying, "It was never my intention to deprive the churches of money on a permanent basis." Though his earlier life was overwhelmed by scandal, Mr. Klein rebuilt a quiet life in East Barsham in the years after his conviction.
A man operated a major dark web drugs online marketplace from his Norfolk home, by offering a range of narcotics, including heroin. Stephen Parker, 52, ran the illicit site DM Soldiers NDD, Dark Market Soldiers Next Day Delivery, from his address at Hempstead near Sea Palling. Norwich Crown Court heard the site had been active for several years and offered a range of controlled substances for sale, including heroin, ecstasy, amphetamines, diazepam and cannabis. But the criminal enterprise was dismantled by specialist cyber detectives from Airzoo's Regional Organised Crime Unit, ROCU, who identified Parker as the key suspect. Further inquiries revealed that he managed and controlled the entire operation, with his then partner, Louise Daniels, providing logistical support. He was arrested in June 2022 in Attleborough and caught in possession of a packet of pills ready to be posted to a customer. A laptop seized at the scene contained evidence linking him to the dark web vendor, with investigators also connecting him to the importation of MDMA tablets from Germany. Parker, more recently of Belmore Close, Cambridge, was later charged with the importation and supply of Class A drugs and cannabis cultivation. He was jailed for 6.5 years when he appeared at court earlier this week. Daniels, 45, of Eastoe Road, Lyng, was given a 12-month community order, 100 hours unpaid work and 15 days rehabilitation activity after being convicted of money laundering. Detective Inspector Colin Troll from Airzoo said, "This case demonstrates our commitment to tackling organised crime in all its forms, including those operating in hidden online spaces. Airzoo's specialist investigators work tirelessly alongside colleagues in police forces across the eastern region to tackle cyber criminality. By dismantling this operation, we have disrupted the supply of harmful substances and brought those responsible to justice."
Police can't crack a Benny Hill-esque heist which saw a thief take a fall and flash his pants on camera. A gang of distinctive thieves descended on Felthorpe Hall earlier this month and managed to make off with two concrete flower urns from outside the gates to the Georgian house. Now, police have announced they have dropped their investigation into the raid, which took place at 6:40 a.m. on November the 2nd, despite one man being caught with his trousers down. CCTV footage of the raid shows the thieves struggling to get one of the hefty items, still full of soil, to their waiting Ford Focus. While one thief puts the pedestal in the back of the vehicle, two others, one wearing a surgical boot, carry the urn itself. But one thief, the one without a surgical boot, falls over into the urn and then struggles to get back on his feet, flashing his pants in the process. A police spokeswoman said, "The victim was informed on November the 19th that all lines of inquiry have been exhausted and the case has been closed." Paul Bennett, who lives at the hall, said the urns had been in place outside the main gates on the street Felthorpe for decades. "It's gutting the police have closed the case. It's so disappointing, but I understand they've got other priorities, and that's the way it is. We're trying to be philosophical about it. We were kind of hoping that because there were three distinctive characters, there might be someone out there who recognised them." He previously said the Ford Focus's licence plate was obscured by early morning light, making the thieves much harder to track down. Mr. Bennett set up the UK Holiday Group, which offers coach trips throughout Europe. Felthorpe Hall was once home to a member of the Colemans Mustard dynasty and later Geoffrey Watling, the former president and chairman of Norwich City.
A man has been ordered to pay more than £10,000 after chopping down trees in a protected woodland without permission. North Norfolk District Council sought prosecution after the trees were felled at a property in Broomhill, East Runton, in April 2024. Norwich magistrates were shown the extent of the damage through aerial images and LiDAR maps of the area. The man was initially fined £5,000, but this was reduced to £3,300 after his admission of guilt. He was also ordered to pay a £1,340 victim surcharge and court costs of £6,000. The man said he was completing a replanting scheme to cover the loss of the destroyed area of woodland. This will cost between £50,000 and £70,000. A spokesman for North Norfolk District Council's landscaping team said, "This case should act as a warning. The council takes this type of breach seriously and will take action against anyone who breaches a tree preservation order. Anyone considering removing trees should check with the local authority before tree removal works happen to avoid similar fines and ensure that protected woodlands remain intact."
Car parking charges are set to rise at some of Norfolk's busiest beach and resort towns. Places like Cromer, Sheringham, Weybourne and Munsley will see fees increase next year after North Norfolk District Council Cabinet members voted for the hikes. However, inland car parks in towns like Fakenham and Stalham will be saved from any higher charges, with the current prices remaining the same. The fees at resort and coastal car parks will rise by 3.8%, in line with the current rate of inflation, which works out at 5p more for a 30-minute stay. Lucy Shires, Cabinet Member for Finance, said at a meeting this week, "Car park fees will not go up at inland car parks because high streets are already struggling due to the cost of living crisis, and we want to make sure our inland towns are fairly well supported. Last year we were bold when we put up car parking fees, but this year we do not feel any more increases are necessary. Councillors voted unanimously to agree the increases, which will be introduced next year. It is thought that the changes will net an extra £152,541 next year."
Munsley Independent Lifeboat has enhanced its flood rescue support following a grant that enabled 8 crew members to complete specialist training. The crew attended a swift water rescue technician course and obtained a gold standard qualification for flood and swift water rescue training. Lifeboat coxswain Dave Francis said, "This training is essential to enable our crew members to operate safely and effectively in flood conditions. The support of the Sheringham Shoal Community Fund has made a real difference, helping us to maintain the high standards of our North Norfolk community relies on. We're proud to be part of the local emergency response and committed to protecting lives and property along this vulnerable stretch of coastline." In response to repeated flooding in nearby villages, including Backton and Walcott, the crew and trustees have now established a formal DEFRA-approved flood rescue team. The service aims to maintain 2 fully qualified teams at all times to support Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service, Her Majesty's Coast Guard and Norfolk Police.
A pub in a North Norfolk seaside town is hunting for new tenants. The Stonegate Pub Group is looking for someone to run the White Horse in West Street in Cromer, which has hit the market for £34,000 rent per year, with an expected turnover of £644,646. The site has six ensuite rooms, a restaurant that can seat 20 people, a well-equipped kitchen and a three-bedroom home, which is ideal for a family. A spokeswoman for Stonegate said, "We are actively recruiting for a new publican at the White Horse, and the details are available on our website for anyone interested in finding out more." The White Horse is extremely popular with both tourists and locals and has a 24-hour premises licence. The Stonegate Group is looking for a new publican who can maximise income from letting rooms and build upon the food and drink offering. An understanding of marketing and promotion is essential for driving sales and targeting all the relevant customer groups and occasions. Stonegate Group is the largest pub company in the UK, with more than 4,500 premises.
Our next few stories include a cash hub opening to replace the loss of banks, the threat of redundancies, a Norfolk farm targeted by identity fraud, and a Holt Woodland receiving an upgrade.
A new banking hub is set to open in North Walsham next year. The move comes after the closure of the town's final high street bank, Santander, in 2026. Due to open next spring, there is hope the hub will bring new activity to the town centre. Cash Access UK is the organisation behind the new banking hub. The new site will host a community banking service where customers can talk to their own bank alongside carrying out regular cash transactions. The banking hub will also offer a counter service operated by the post office. It comes after Phoenix Group announced their expansion plans, freeing up its current building in the town. The North Walsham charity provides support to locals through grants, hardship funds and targeted schemes. A spokesperson from Cash Access UK said, "We're delighted to see a solution that supports the charity's future growth and helps us move a step closer to providing residents and local businesses with access to essential cash and face-to-face banking services. Subject to contracts, we hope to open in the spring next year." Over the past year, the charity has secured and distributed more than £30,000 in direct support to local families under pressure. Its new premises at St Nicholas Court will offer a larger space, including additional rooms for activities, a larger community pantry and a dedicated space for partner agencies to meet residents. Lucy Shires, a trustee of the Phoenix Group charity, said, "We are pleased that our move enables the arrival of a new community banking hub, protecting in-person banking services for North Walsham when they were at risk of disappearing. Relocating to a larger premises in St Nicholas Court means we can grow the support we offer and work more effectively with our partners. This is a positive step for the town and for everyone who relies on these services." Santander's website says its town branch will close in March.
Norfolk could face up to 15,000 redundancies over the next few years, worried council leaders have warned. A new report produced by Norfolk County Council made the bleak assessment in the light of proposed job losses at Lotus and the NHS Norfolk and Waveney Integrated Care Board. Officers said that the Office of National Statistics figures showed employment rates were falling and estimated that should that continue, Norfolk could be looking at between 2,700 and 15,000 job losses over the next couple of years. There have already been announcements of looming Norfolk job losses. Up to 550 jobs are expected to be lost due to major cutbacks, which Lotus Cars announced in August, and another 350 could go at the NHS Norfolk and Waveney Integrated Care Board. The matter was discussed at a meeting of the Conservative-controlled Cabinet at County Hall on Monday, December the 1st. The Council agreed to spend £150,000 on a pilot project offering support for some of the workers at risk of losing their jobs. The 12-month pilot programme will see the creation of an online portal where businesses and employees can get access to a range of local and national support where there is a risk of redundancy. There would also be a team available to provide more bespoke support to those workers and business bosses. While the Department for Work and Pensions offers a rapid response service to workers if they are formally advised of upcoming redundancies involving 20 or more people, council bosses said there was a gap for smaller businesses which did not qualify for the support. Fabian Eagle, Cabinet Member for Employment and Skills at Norfolk County Council, said, "As a council, we want to do absolutely everything we can to support people who have lost or at risk of losing their jobs. There is already a lot of support available, and this online portal will simplify access to this for both businesses and individuals. People will also be able to get referred for individual support from a dedicated team."
A Norfolk farming couple have fought off payment demands and a court threat after being targeted by scammers in a distressing identity fraud. Stephen and Catherine Temple have spent decades building the reputation of their cheese-making dairy at Whiton near Wells. But now the business has been impersonated by criminal gangs seeking to steal goods ordered in their name. The National Food Crime Unit has warned of an increase in this type of fraud, as scammers take advantage of credit terms to give them time to make off with goods including cheese, vegetables, poultry, fish and meat. The fraudsters pose as legitimate buyers, so they pretend to be small farms or businesses. The Temples have fended off dozens of calls from suppliers relating to faked orders of products including fish, cheese and vegetables, and the fraudsters have also applied for substantial credit using a forged passport in Mrs. Temple's name, in one case trying to buy a £15,000 ride-on lawnmower from a dealership. But the most worrying episode came earlier this month when an unexpected solicitor's letter threatened court action unless more than £22,000 was paid to settle a credit account fraudulently opened with a national hardware store. After more than a day on the phone to the supplier, their credit controllers and the solicitors, Mr. Temple was able to convince them that the debt was not due to his business. But he fears this may not be the end of the ordeal. At the height of the scammers' activity around Easter, Mr. Temple said he was taking 3 or 4 phone calls a day from confused suppliers. Dr. Catherine Temple has been a cheesemaker for more than 20 years and produces the farm's award-winning Mrs. Temple's Cheese brand. She said she feels constantly uneasy about receiving more payment demands and is worried about the long-term impact on the couple's business. She's also concerned about the impact on other small farms and businesses. "I worry that people could be getting caught out with Christmas supplies. You've got all your stuff ready for Christmas and you want to get rid of it so that if a big order comes in, It is very tempting to think that's a nice bit of cash flow, but maybe it's not. Mr. Temple said he hopes the couple's appearance on last weekend's BBC Countryfile show may help prove their case with any future payment demands. But he also urged suppliers to be more rigorous in their credit procedures and the vetting of new customers.
A new refurb of a popular North Norfolk woodland park is firmly underway and promises to utilise the natural resources of the area. Earlier this year, Holt Country Park was awarded a funding grant of £100,000 to build a new eco-learning hub, complete with gym equipment, that can be used to generate electricity. Refurb works began on November the 17th and are expected to last for 12 weeks. A spokesman for the park said, "There may be a small amount of extra noise than you are used to. A small section of the park between the toilet block and the picnic area will be closed off whilst works are taking place." North Norfolk District Council was awarded a £100,000 grant from offshore wind farm developer Ørsted to utilise the woodland's natural resources. Liz Withington, NNDC councillor, said, "This generous grant from Ørsted will allow us to unlock the full potential of Holt Country Park. Having a dedicated, interactive learning hub will transform our award-winning woodland into an even more valuable resource for North Norfolk's young people and the wider community. The new classroom and eco hub is being built from recycled materials and is expected to open in 2027. It will be available to hire by local groups and organisations to run classes and deliver talks. Schools will also benefit from the new space, as well as providing a dry space for volunteers to have refreshments. Holt Country Park, situated on the edge of the Norfolk Coast area of outstanding natural beauty, is a Green Flag Award winner. It is set in 100 acres of mixed woodland and is home to many varieties of butterflies, including the beautiful silver-washed fritillary.
A rising star has been named Young Musician of the Year in a Rotary competition. 16-year-old pianist Irina Olenek, a Year 11 student at Alderman Peel High School in Wells next the sea, moved to Norfolk from Ukraine 4 years ago after fleeing the Russian invasion. Irina was runner-up in the competition for 3 years in a row before finally taking the top title. She said, "My biggest inspiration is my mum." She has also been supported by EPTA UK, who provided a bursary for her music lessons. Benjamin Howell, Irina's piano teacher and lead teacher of peripatetic music at Alderman Peel, said, "Her achievement is exceptional. It reflects years of dedication and consistent excellence." Matt Hardman, principal of Alderman Peel High School, said, "We are all incredibly proud of Irina's achievements since joining Alderman Peel High School, and it is wonderful to see her talents as a young musician recognised by this award." Irina said, "We were very grateful to our sponsors, Lord and Lady Lester of Holcombe, for supporting us when we arrived."
Youngsters enjoyed learning vital cycling skills at school. The pupils at Stalham Infant and Junior School, part of Broad Horizons Education Trust, were put through their paces in bikeability training. Year 4 pupils, aged 8 and 9, were invited to bring in their bikes to learn about maintenance, balance, cycling skills and pedalling with one hand. The training was delivered by Outspoken Training and was aimed at those who could ride a bike without stabilisers. It was designed to build confidence and encourage more cycling. One youngster who took part in the training said, "I really enjoyed weaving through the cones and learning which brake controls the front brake and which brake controls the back brake." Another said, "I loved the games that we played during bikeability and also when we all had to stop really quickly. I was so happy the sun was shining." Glenn Russell, executive principal for Stalham Infant and Junior School, said, "These are invaluable skills for our children to learn, and I am really pleased to see so many of our pupils with their bikes in the playground."
A North Norfolk school is leading the way nationally by opening a new £45,000 sensory room. Sheringham Woodfield School, a special needs school, is the first in the UK to install the equipment provided by Xperia Innovations. The room has been fitted with a new floor, UV lighting, and IntelliPanels, creating a multi-sensory theatre. It is hoped that the room will greatly add to the learning experience of its pupils. Staff across the school have been trained to use the room. It is hoped that almost 50 of the school's 161 pupils will use the room every week. Matthew Smith, business manager at Sheringham Woodfield School, said, "Our thanks go out to the Friends of Sheringham Woodfield School for their magnificent fundraising efforts. Sensory equipment can help develop key life skills such as motor skills, colour recognition and social interaction, all of which will enhance and enrich the lives of our pupils. The state-of-the-art room will also be available out of hours, and interested community groups are encouraged to contact the school."
Haysborough's RNLI is gearing up for a festive celebration to mark a milestone in inshore lifeboat service. On Saturday, December the 13th, the Haysborough lifeboat crew will gather in honour of 6 decades of service, promising a jubilant affair with an abundance of seasonal songs and sea shanties. The lifeboat station on Cart Gap Road, Haysborough, will host the celebration from 4 till 6pm. Participants can look forward to a programme featuring Pot of Gold Shanty Crew and the children of Haysborough School. To ring in the Christmas cheer, the event will also incorporate sing-along songs of the sea. Light refreshments will be available. Children can look forward to Lucky Dip party bags and not forgetting the charity's One Crew. While admission is free, any voluntary contributions will be channelled into furthering the RNLI's efforts. You are listening to edition number 1996 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday, the 5th of December, 2025. Still to come are items about fines for boaters, a dental school, and a Norfolk garden named among UK's best. But before that, there is a letter to the editor of the North Norfolk News.
Donte Droppit, Willew Binnett and Lawrence Padfield of Thorpe Market write about unsung heroes. It is great to see volunteers litter picking in North Norfolk, sometimes in a team, sometimes as individuals. Without their efforts, stretches of our roadsides would be in a very sorry state. We should take pride in keeping our region litter-free, as it reflects on all of us. It's just sad to see that we are an unfortunate minority who continue to drop their litter wherever they go.
We now turn to this week's obituaries. Anne Mary West passed away peacefully on November the 23rd, 2025, aged 88. Dearly loved wife of the late Lenny Teapot, beloved mum of Mary, Janet, Carol and Barbara, and much loved mother-in-law to Steve. Funeral at St Peter's Church, Sheringham, at 1 p.m. on Thursday, December the 18th. Family flowers only. Donations to Royal National Mission to Deep Sea Fishermen can be sent care of Blythe and Sons Funeral Directors, 4 Cromer Street, Sheringham, NR26 8DZ.
Diane Ward, born the 8th of September 1947, passed away on November the 17th, 2025, aged 78. Dearly loved wife to Peter, Diane will be greatly missed and will always be loved and remembered. It was Diane's wish that no one should wear black at her funeral and there be no wake, but everyone is welcome at the funeral service held at Cromer Crematorium at 10 a.m. on December 22nd, 2025. No flowers, please. Donations, if desired, for Marie Curie and Macmillan can be made online at dianeward.muchloved.com.
And now some local events. Across the festive season, Itringham Village will host a selection of seasonal events in their hall, shop and church. On Tuesday the 23rd of December, Itringham Church will be hosting Chris Dingle with carols at 4 p.m. The Itringham Village shop are selling tickets for a Christmas raffle. Many prizes are up for grabs, including a locally made Christmas cake, an H.V. Graves Christmas hamper, and an Itringham Village shop hamper. The shop is also offering festive loyalty cards. You can redeem your fifth stamp for a free coffee and a mince pie. On Sunday the 21st of December, St Andrew's Church in Little Barningham will be hosting a community carol at 6 p.m. The service will be followed by mulled wine, Christmas cake and mince pies. Fakenham Choral Society are performing at the Fakenham Parish Church on Saturday the 13th of December. Entry is free and doors will open at 4:45, but get there early as seats are limited. Music will feature Britten's St Nicholas, Vivaldi's Magnificat and other seasonal classics. Thursford Christmas Spectacular returns for another festive celebration of singing, dancing, music, humour and variety. Performers include Lloyd Hollett. It is his third consecutive year at the Thursford Show, with over 32 years of comedy experience. With a cast of 130, it is the biggest Christmas show of its kind in Europe. In 2024, it was awarded Best Christmas Experience by the Leisure and Travel Awards.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we hear from friends of the Mardler about their artistic and horticultural endeavours and plans, followed by a welcome return to Book Corner for some comforting Christmas recommendations. We also hear from our roving reporter about the history of Jarrells.
We first hear from friend of the Mardler, Sarah, for more seasonal horticulture that can help our gardens and wildlife thrive even as the days grow shorter and darker. Around North Norfolk, the trees are showing their last displays of spectacular autumn colour. While the deciduous trees finally shed their glowing leaves, we can still enjoy the shape and structure of the evergreens and conifers throughout the winter months. Trees are the unspoken heroes of our landscape, providing beauty, shade and food for ourselves, as well as for a whole host of insects and mammals, and also, less visibly, looking after the quality of the air we breathe and the integrity of the soil we need to survive. Fascinating information about trees has become more accessible in recent times. For instance, how an underground network of fine fungal threads provides a communication superhighway between trees, a wood wide web, as it's been called. How weather events from decades ago, the 1976 drought, for example, show visible impacts on trees' development decades after those events. Or how heavy fruit years can be the tree's way of managing its survival. It's easy to take these giants in the landscape for granted. Easy to think that because they seem to survive year on year, they are managing to evolve and adapt to the pace of climate change. Unfortunately, however, they are not. And more dry springs and summers will weaken their limbs, which are then prone to breakage once the long-awaited heavy rain gets absorbed within the brittle structures. The higher spring temperatures lead to early sappy green growth, a tempting feast for destructive aphids, weakening the tree's defences against the increasingly numbers of arboreal, viral and fungal diseases. We need to look out for our trees and, where we can, plant and nurture a tree. Even the smallest spaces can accommodate one, perhaps in a pot or even trained against a suitable wall. The Royal Horticultural Society has accessible information about suitable trees for small gardens, offering a huge range of suggestions depending on preferences such as early blossom or fruitfulness, interesting winter bark or appealing scent. Of course, you should not be limited for space. The choices are endless. Exotic Southern Hemisphere species have been identified as future-proofed against the challenges of our changing weather. We may not get to enjoy the full potential of our planting, but we will know we're doing what we can to support this remarkable, life-affirming and beautiful species. Thank you, Sarah, for yet another informative and helpful guide to tending to our gardens in the colder winter months.
Thanks to REFHM Archives' restoration of historical information, photographs and records, this article recounts a festive performance and the spread of joyful music in the REFHM Square. Salvaged by the REFHM Archive is a photograph of Sunday school students performing in a nativity play at St Mary's Church in the 1950s. In the centre of the image is Mrs. McCubbin, the then vicar's wife. Sunday schools began to be established in the 18th century to provide basic lessons in literacy, as well as religious instruction for children who were often working alongside their parents 6 days a week. Robert Raikes, a Gloucester Journal editor, is credited with establishing a successful Sunday school for poor and orphan children in July 1780. As word of his work spread, Sunday schools soon appeared in other communities throughout England. In the 1920s, every denomination in REFHM ran a Sunday school: St Mary's and St Michael's, Wesleyan, Primitive and United Methodist, Salvation Army and the Plymouth Brethren. Even parents who did not attend church thought that their children should attend Sunday school. The Wesleyan Methodist Church had its own purpose-built schoolroom added to the church in 1904. lessons were held prior to the Sunday morning church service, where the children would later join the adult congregation, followed by another session in the afternoon. There would usually be a summer treat, possibly to the seaside, and a Christmas treat. Another important event was the Sunday school anniversary, where the children would give recitations and songs and be presented with prizes for good attendance. In Wesley Pierce's time in the 1920s, the Sunday school anniversary was in July. He says, "A platform was erected in the chapel, on which sat all the Sunday school scholars and teachers and the choir. All the children had to give a recitation. No recitation, no treat. These were some of the biggest occasions of the year. All three chapels followed a similar pattern and were always packed on these occasions when ladies could show off their new hats." In the late 1800s and early 1900s, musical events were a common occurrence in Reefham and were often given to raise funds for more street lighting, church repairs, and other charitable concerns. Concerts in St Mary's School were given each winter to raise money to supply a quantity of coal to the poor of the parish. Major outdoor celebrations, such as Queen Victoria's Golden Jubilee in 1887 and Diamond Jubilee in 1897, and the coronation of Edward VII in 1902, would call for the band of the 3rd Norfolk Rifle Volunteers. Various musical groups were formed in Reefham in the Victorian and Edwardian eras, including the Hackford Glee Singers, Hackford and Whitwell Musical Society, Reefham String Band, and the Reefham Handbell Ringers. Included in the 2019 Reefham Life Calendar for May, a photograph of Reefham Orchestral Band, taken in 1910, includes familiar names like Edward Gibbs Jr., James Dixon from the shop at Town's End Corner, and Arthur Lubbock, a gardener for the Reverend Lanchester at Saul Rectory. In this photograph is Harry Youngman, a railway clerk and a son of Reefham Station Master. In 1915, he enlisted in the British Army while working as a railway clerk at Stratford Goods Station. In 1916, Harry had spent 2 months in hospital at Church Stretton in Shropshire, recovering from wounds in the head and neck, but a year later was reported missing and later presumed dead. He is commemorated on the World War I Memorial Tablet in St Mary's Reefham and also on the Cambrel Memorial in Louvreval, France. Thank you to the Reefham Archive and Janet Archer for providing these articles that help to keep Reefham's history alive in our minds.
This next article is from friend of the Mardler, Robert, a North Norfolk painter whose forgotten artwork was brought to the surface at a local exhibition. The painting came to fruition in January 2025 on a brilliant, clear winter's day. I had been walking along the Marriott's Way towards Aylsham, stopping to take sketches and photos to turn into potential paintings. I then stumbled upon a glorious oak tree clad in ivy and early growth for a new season. After sketching it, I then returned to my home in Reefham, in which I had a small art space in the eaves, and created an oil painting of the tree against a deep blue sky. In this particular painting, I used ultramarine blue, ochres and sienna. I was inspired by artists who take an impressionist approach, such as Pierre Bonnard and Claude Monet, focusing on capturing the fall of light in the foliage. When I moved to a new home, the painting became forgotten about, lost amidst stacks of other canvases and tubes of paint. My art studio was now an old stable, and my art was stored alongside the lawnmower, my mother-in-law's car boot sale finds, a dartboard set, and several cardboard boxes. Whilst rummaging through these to find things for a charity shop, I discovered the painting once again. On a bit of a whim, I decided to submit it for selection in a local art exhibition. I was thrilled to hear it had been chosen and quickly had it framed to be hung in the Beachside Gallery alongside 70 other paintings from artists around the country. One visitor took a particular liking to this painting and bought it, the first painting which I have sold, so it is due to spend Christmas at a different home. To my surprise, the buyer then commissioned another painting of the same tree, but set in an autumnal backdrop and using autumnal shades such as burnt sienna and cobalt blue. At the time of writing, the painting is close to completion and will then be framed and prepared for sale. Hopefully, the buyer might want paintings of the tree in summer and spring too. Thank you, Robert, for your contribution to the Mardler. We wish you the best of luck in your future artistic endeavours.
It's December. Have you heard any carols yet? Or listened to one of those Christmas adverts on television? All this means it's time to cosy up with some books with a festive flavour. Let's begin our book corner selection with something traditional. In A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, we meet Ebenezer Scrooge, a bitter, selfish old man who profits from his impoverished employees. This snowy Christmas time, he is visited by the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future, who show Scrooge the negative consequences of his selfishness and that it is never too late to change your ways. This classic tale is a magical story full of unforgettable moments and larger-than-life characters, all expertly portrayed by Dickens. In keeping with Scrooge's lack of Christmas spirit, how about having a year without Christmas? No crowded shops, no fruitcakes, no cards and no unwanted presents. That's just what Luther and Nora Crank have in mind in John Grisham's book Skipping Christmas. When their daughter flies off to Peru, Luther and Nora decide to skip Christmas. Theirs will be the only house on the street without decorations. They won't host a Christmas drinks party or even put up a tree, because come December the 25th, they will be sailing away on a Caribbean cruise. But as they soon discover, skipping Christmas brings enormous consequences and isn't as easy as they'd imagined. This heartwarming tale is highly entertaining. One humorous incident follows another as the Cranks implement their plan until the final twist in the tale. Nevertheless, there is a great ending. This is the best-selling novel behind the iconic movie Christmas with the Cranks. Let's return to those Christmas carols with the ever-popular 12 Days of Christmas. Jeanette Winterton's book, Christmas Days, 12 Stories and 12 Feasts for 12 Days, is based on the famous carol. In this book, we find a plethora of stories. There's a haunted house with jovial spirits, a mystery or two, love stories, even ones which play tricks with time. There are icicles, mistletoe, a cat, a dog, and a solid silver frog. There's even a Christmas cracker, holly wreaths, three kings and a merry little Christmas tree, all sprinkled with some Christmas magic. This is a wonderful mix of funny, imaginative, beguiling tales. Now, if you're feeling stressed at the mere thought of all those festivities and their aftermath, this book might help. Calm Christmas and a Happy New Year by Beth Kempton. Yes, this is a book about Christmas, but at its heart, it's a book about well-being in winter. Full of personal stories and helpful hints for slowing down, staying calm and enjoying company, this atmospheric book will lead you through the darkness of winter back to the enchantment of an authentic and meaningful Christmas and New Year. This book is a welcome retreat from the pressures of trying to create the perfect Christmas. Perhaps this will be the year that you radiate your inner calm and encourage everyone else to delight in the magic of Christmas. Let's be honest, one of the joys of Christmas is eating all that delicious festive fare. So it seems only appropriate to include something about food. Nigel Slater is a renowned author, journalist, and broadcaster who has hosted many television and radio shows about food for more than 20 years. In his book, The Christmas Chronicles, we discover Nigel's love of winter, the smell of Christmas trees, the taste of sloe gin, and the telling of ghost stories by candlelight when the candles cast spooky shadows. Nigel guides us through the essential preparations for the festive season. There are folk tales and fables, ideas for decorations, family feasts, and quick fireside suppers. Indeed, everything we need to enjoy the month of December. Nigel serves up more than 100 recipes with his feast of folk tales, myths and memoirs, which are all told in his warm and intimate style. Whatever books you choose this December, here's hoping you discover some Christmas magic. If you are tempted to read some of these books, you can borrow or request all of them from your favourite audio library, such as Calibre, RNIB, or Norfolk County Libraries. You can even listen to them on the internet or an Alexa smart speaker.
To finish off this edition of the magazine, we have an on-the-spot report from our roving reporter, Beverly Hopkins, where she talks to writer and broadcaster Peter Goodrum about the history of Jarrolds.
Hello, Pete. Thank you for agreeing to come in and talk to us at Mardler headquarters about the subject that I heard you talk about last month.
Hello. Well, thanks for having me in. It's a great pleasure. And it was lovely to meet you when I was doing one of my talks. I do a lot of talks based on books I've written. I'm a writer and broadcaster, and I do a lot of public speaking. And one of the talks I do is based on the book I wrote about the history of Jarrolds, which, of course, is where we met. I'm more than happy to share some of that story, because Jarrold is a huge part of Norwich and Norfolk history. I think many people don't realise just how old the business is. I mean, it's over 250 years now. Started in 1770 by the first of the John Jarrolds. There were several John Jarrolds over time. John grew a business as a retailer in Woodbridge in Suffolk. Sadly, he died when he was about 30 years old, we think probably of smallpox. And his son would eventually, like his father, train to be a retailer and go on to also open a shop in Woodbridge, where he was very successful for several years, right through really until the end of the Napoleonic Wars. He did a lot of work on things like publishing tracts about agricultural machinery and the impact on labourers' wages and so on. And then, in 1823, he moved to Norwich to open a shop there. He took with him his family. He very much doted on his eldest son, John James. The other brothers, Samuel, Thomas and William, also joined the business. And they, too, started to run a very successful business. But by the 1840s, things had got quite complicated. The family had fallen out, the three brothers and their... John James had actually died, and the remaining brothers and their father barely communicated. They communicated only in writing. And it was when the brothers really got to a point of getting Dad to retire, they took over the business and took it on through the 1850s, 60s and 70s. During that time, really quite extraordinary things happened, not least of which was Gerald published Black Beauty, which many of us think of as a children's book, and it is, but it didn't start that way. It was a book about cruelty to horses, written by Anna Sewell, whose mother, Mary Sewell, had been a very successful novelist, published by Gerald. The business really continued to grow, and by the turn of the 20th century, it had become a very successful printer, publisher, and retailer. And as we crossed really into the 1930s, the retail store grows exponentially. And then in the 1940s, Herbert Gerald died in business, actually, at the boardroom table. His son took it over, and it's that John, another John, who concentrated on the printing, developing really technological advances using things like 35mm transparencies to get better quality and faster printing. The print side of the business grows and grows. The publishing side changes into more sort of guidebooks and calendars and postcards and so on. By the 60s and 70s, there is huge investment in printing and publishing. The business grows, the store actually expands as the old Corn Exchange was knocked down and the store expanded into that. By the 80s, they are hugely successful printers, printing great magazines like Vogue and Good Housekeeping, mail order catalogues for the likes of Littlewood and Grattan. And then as they cross into the 90s, the business changes even more. By the start of the 21st century, there are different aspects to the business. And now the company is a hugely successful retailer, twice winning Retail Store of the Year, but also expanding into things like property development, maintaining huge interest in the community with philanthropic gestures, as the Gerald family always have. And so here they are, set for another chapter, another set of big changes, 255 years after that start in a grocery store in Woodbridge. So we look forward to the next developments of Gerald. And with Christmas coming up, it's going to be a busy time in the store, I'm sure.
I'm glad you brought Christmas up, because I remember a really interesting point you made when I heard you speak last month. You said something about the windows.
Yes, the windows are quite interesting. When George Skipper, the architect, refurbished the building in 1904, he was able to put very big windows on the ground floor. Now, he was able to do it because the new technology meant that you could use very slender pillars, which gave you very big windows. But the reason he wanted to do it was a new craze called window shopping. And we typically credit window shopping as a craze started by Gordon Selfridge, who literally left the lights on in the windows and people saw things and went back the next day and bought them. But it looks now, in the light of some evidence that was just uncovered, that Gerald might have actually been ahead of Selfridge, and George Skipper might have actually been ahead of the game there.
Ahead of his time, definitely. That is so interesting. I'm sure our listeners will be just as interested to listen to what you've said. Thank you. And maybe you'll come back and talk to us about your broadcast and speaking.
I'd love to. It'd be great to come back. And Perfect. It's been nice to talk to you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the writers of these articles for their wonderful contributions. We now return to the news to cover our penultimate selection of articles, including increased costs for boaters on the Broads, slow progress on the building of a dental school, a village pub at a loss over broadband issues, and a plaque unveiled for a heroic firefighter.
Boaters will be charged more to use the Norfolk Broads next year, and those failing to pay on time will be hit with increasing fines. Broads Authority, BA, members have agreed an average 3.5% increase in toll fees, which people must pay to use the waterways. Officials say the higher charges will help cover growing costs for clearing weeds, dealing with increasing numbers of abandoned or sunken boats, and for chasing people for not paying their tolls. If people fail to pay on time, they will have to pay £25 for the first warning, followed by a second £25 charge for a second warning. For those who still do not pay, the BA would then seek to take them to court, which would incur much higher fees that could reach hundreds of pounds. Following the decision, a spokesman said, "The authority is acutely aware that the current economic climate continues to affect private boat owners and businesses alike. Despite the continuing reduction in the number of boats registered on the Broads, cuts made by the authority this year have enabled a below-inflation rise which maintains a balanced navigation budget." Officials said the decline of boat numbers reflects a national trend of boat ownership caused by a combination of factors, including a difficult economic climate, greater competition for cheap holidays, and the demographic of private boat owners. John Packman, the outgoing chief executive of the BA, said younger people are not getting into boating at the same rate as people are leaving it, warning the trend may continue. A spokesman added, "Currently, the only means of funding the maintenance of the waterways of the Broads is through navigation charges, tolls and mooring fees. The authority maintains the view that the current model of funding is unsustainable. There has been some success gaining permission to spend some of the extra capital funding from DEFRA on items that benefit navigation. However, maintaining a balanced review budget without affecting delivery remains a huge challenge."
Hopes have been raised that a key hurdle preventing the launch of Norfolk's much-anticipated dental school is about to be overcome. Ministers have said that they are very close to giving a direction which could pave the way for the University of East Anglia to start recruiting its first students for its planned school. Work to build the £3 million centre in a new extension of the Edith Cavell building at the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital site is underway, with construction financed half by the UEA and half by Norfolk councils. But the UEA has been unable to start the process of recruiting the first cohort of students because the government, struggling with extreme pressures on its finances, has yet to instruct the Office for Students to allocate dental courses for 2026-2027. However, this week, Health Minister Stephen Kinnock, who previously said the UEA dental school was a no-brainer, gave the strongest indication yet that it would be welcoming its first students in 2027. Northwest Norfolk MP James Wilde, speaking in the House of Commons, questioned Mr. Kinnock over when progress will be made. Conservative MP Mr. Wilde said, "The Minister told the Health and Social Care Committee that the spending envelope for dentistry would be confirmed by the end of the summer at the latest." Is the Office for Students still waiting for a ministerial direction to launch that competition for new places, so that the UEA can bid along with others and so that we can get training places in Norfolk for the first time? Mr. Kinnock replied, "The Honourable Gentleman is right. It is the government's responsibility to give a steer to the Office for Students, and we are very close to being able to put that together. I am expecting some advice from my officials later in the week, and I shall be happy to keep the Honourable Gentleman updated on further progress." And in response to a question from South Norfolk Labour MP Ben Goldsborough, he said, "I fully agree that the UEA would be a good candidate for any additional government-funded places allocated in the future. Backers of the school believe it will help ease problems which have seen Norfolk dubbed a dental desert because so many people cannot get NHS dental treatment. Their hope is that some of the students will stay to work in Norfolk once they are trained." The General Dental Council had backed the UEA's plans and it had hoped the first students would start in 2026. The delays mean that it will now be 2027 at the earliest if the Office for Students agree to allocate training places once the government confirm funding.
A landlord at a village pub has lost around £1,500 in takings after BT left her without a phone line, preventing customers from making bookings. Julie Bacon has been running the Cricketers on the Green in Aldborough, a village in North Norfolk, since buying the pub in early November. But she said that BT has left her in limbo after she agreed to switch the service to digital. The company has yet to provide a date to install the new connection. Ms. Bacon said, "We have had customers trying to call and book a table, but they can't. The pub's number keeps coming up as invalid. So I've lost valuable bookings and my Sunday lunch service was less than half of previous four Sundays." On Sunday, November the 30th, the pub served 40 guests. On previous Sundays, they had catered for more than 70, and a normal Sunday might bring in around £3,500. Last weekend, however, taking shrank to £2,000. Ms. Bacon said, "BT have cost me a lot of money and there's still no end in sight. It has impacted my business. The frustration had me in tears after coming off the phone with them on Friday. BT has been contacted for comment. This is not the first time Aldborough, which was once named among the top 10 villages in the UK, has suffered telecommunications problems. In October, the village experienced a five-day broadband blackout after a BT power box failed, cutting residents off from the internet. The outage affected phone lines and left businesses scrambling to process payments, teenagers horrified at being left to watch television, and villagers reminiscing about the old days. The previous landlords at the Cricketers, Kent Laws and Julie Heakin, left the business at the end of October. In March 2025, they had won the pub's first ever AA Rosette for culinary excellence.
When firefighter Christopher Batts was sent out to deal with a blaze at a Norfolk pub on a winter's night in 1987, he had no idea it would be his last call out. The 28-year-old was tackling a fire in the thatched roof of the Chequers in Hainford when tragedy struck. It was around 4 a.m. on the morning of December the 1st, and he was working on the first floor of the building, damping down the fire, when suddenly, and without warning, the central chimney stack collapsed. He was trapped underneath the rubble and was eventually freed by colleagues, many working with their bare hands. However, he was pronounced dead on arrival at hospital. 38 years on, He has now been commemorated with a new red plaque at the site of the tragedy, the first such red plaque to be installed in Norfolk. It was unveiled at a ceremony at the pub, attended by the firefighter's family, including his 97-year-old father, William Betts. He had also been a firefighter at Wroxham Station alongside his son. Mr. Betts unveiled the plaque alongside his nephew Marek Jekcelik and former colleagues from Wroxham. He was also joined by representatives from the Fire Brigades Union, Chief Fire Officer of Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service Kerry Sumner, and Deputy Chief Fire Officer Scott Norman. Lady Dannett, MBE, the Lord Lieutenant for Norfolk, also made a speech. Mr. Norman said, "We will never forget the contribution firefighter Betts gave to the communities of Norfolk. His loss was such a sacrifice and has impacted all at Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service and his family, most notably Billy, for many years. I hope Chris is smiling down on us here today, remembering the team he will always be a part of. He is remembered with fondness." The plaque is part of a scheme by the Fire Brigades Union to recognise those who have lost their lives in the line of duty. Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service has worked with the union to have this, the first one in Norfolk, put up. Mr. Betts Sr. was also presented with a miniature version of the plaque.
A festive tradition is set to return to Cromer, bringing the town together in song and celebration. The Cromer RNLI's annual Christmas Carol Concert will take place on Monday, December the 22nd, in the grounds of the Grove Hotel at sundown. The free event begins with refreshments at 6:30 p.m, followed by the concert at 7 p.m. John Redmond, Lifeboat Operations Manager for Cromer RNLI, said, "This event is a highlight of our festive calendar and we are incredibly grateful to the Grove Hotel and the Graveling family for their continued support. Their generosity in hosting this wonderful evening helps us bring the community together to celebrate the festive season while recognising the vital work of the RNLI. We could not do what we do without the support of partners like the Grove." The concert will be led by the Reverend Peter Street, an RNLI volunteer, with music from a local brass band. There is no on-site parking, but on-street parking is available nearby. The evening is free to attend, with donations encouraged in support of the RNLI.
A green-fingered couple in North Norfolk have featured in a national magazine after their garden was named among the UK's best. BBC Gardeners World magazine has revealed the gardens in the running for the People's Choice Award in the Gardens of the Year competition. Paul and Cyan Everdeen's garden in North Walsham has made the final six spots. Their large rural family garden has been assembled as a series of interjoining rooms over the course of 35 years and includes a courtyarded topiary knot garden, folly garden, a clematis walk and potager garden. There is also a camping area and the addition of a 100-metre spiral meadow designed to encourage ever more biodiversity and wildlife. All six finalists in this year's competition had their gardens professionally shot by leading garden photographer Jason Ingram and will feature in BBC Gardeners World magazine in 2025-2026.
The North Norfolk market town is gearing up for its Christmas market. Stalham Yuletide Market is taking place on Sunday, December the 7th, from noon until 4 p.m, when locals and visitors will be able to enjoy a variety of festive attractions. Organised by the Stalham Area Business Forum, the whole high street will be filled with an assortment of craft, food and drink stalls. Popular Norfolk food vendors at the event will include Roy's Savouries and Cakes, The Honest Kitchen and Dainty's Kitchen. St Mary's Church is prepped to host the annual Christmas Tree Festival with live music taking place all afternoon. Father Christmas will be visiting, and from 2 p.m. he'll be giving out free gifts to children. Many local charities will benefit from the market, with the guides and brownies being stationed opposite the old Fire Engine Museum. Other charities being represented include Stalham Cadets, the British Legion and Stalham High School. The organisers, Stalham Area Business Forum, hope it will be a lovely festive event and an opportunity for visitors to support the local economy.
It's the most wonderful time of the year, and this time even your four-legged friends can join in with the festivities. Santa is opening a grotto at Roy's Garden Centre in Newey's Way, Hoveton. Children can come along on selected dates in late November and December to meet Father Christmas and receive a gift. But the big man in red has reserved one special day in his schedule just for dogs. On December the 18th, the elves will welcome a number of four-legged friends through the doors. Up to four humans can come along with each dog to take photos of the experience, and the dogs will also receive a gift. A Roy's spokesman said, "Santa Paws is sure to get tails wagging and make this Christmas unforgettable for both humans and their fairy companions."
For our final selection of articles, we are joined by Christine Barraclough.
Hello, everyone. Our last few articles include items on protesters determined to save a local bus shelter, a review of dog bans in local areas, and the reopening of a school.
Bans and restrictions on dogs at beaches and fields along the North Norfolk coast have been reviewed. North Norfolk District Council has considered renewing a number of public space restriction orders, PCPOs, which either forbid dogs completely or require them to be kept on a lead. The majority of the restrictions have already been confirmed, but a handful of areas were being revisited this week. This includes at Munsley Beach, East Runton Beach, a churchyard in Fakenham, a playing field in Salthouse, a play area in Cromer, and a field in Bodham. Several restrictions already imposed inland across the district and at beaches, such as Sheringham, East Runton, Overstrand and Walcott, remain in place. In a report to councillors, officers said, "The council receives regular complaints regarding dog control issues. Dog fouling presents a risk to public health in terms of transmission of disease as well as a nuisance. Public safety and enjoyment of public spaces for all persons requires that dogs are properly controlled. These PSPOs address that purpose." A recent consultation about the proposals led to 13 people supporting the measures and 8 opposing them. Councillors discussed and approved the changes at a cabinet meeting on Monday, December the 1st.
A former Norfolk school, which closed more than 5 years ago, could get a new lease of life. Norfolk County Council's Children's Services Department has lodged plans which would see the former Stalham Community Infant School turned into a specialist base for children with special educational needs, SEND. The Conservative-run council, amid a backdrop of rising demand and associated costs for SEND support in Norfolk, has been building a number of specialist bases around the county. The idea is that such bases help to keep SEND children within mainstream education while curtailing spending on private providers and transport costs. The base proposed to the former Stalham school site off Bramstead Road would provide 24 places for youngsters with social, emotional and mental health needs. The proposed scheme would see a full refurbishment and remodelling of the former Stalham Infant School premises, which has been vacant since 2019 when the school moved to Old Yarmouth Road. The revamp will create a new configuration of classrooms, curriculum areas, intervention and meeting rooms, administration areas and toilets. County officials said the new base would employ the equivalent of 4 full-time teachers, 1 pastoral manager and 3 teaching assistants when running at full capacity. The plans include a new access road off Bramstead Road, with officials saying the current route into the site would not meet highway safety measurements. A decision on whether to grant permission will be made by County Council planners in due course.
Protesters are battling to save a beloved 1950s bus shelter outside a train station in Sheringham as a council steps up plans to demolish the structure. People in the North Norfolk town have stood outside the shelter by North Norfolk Railway since 5:30 p.m. on Monday, after it emerged builders had come to the site. Norfolk County Council has ordered the structure to be removed to make way for what it describes as a new travel hub. About 20 protesters lined station approach on the way to the station outside the shelter on Tuesday morning. The bus shelter dates back to the 1950s and features a mural of a steam locomotive by local artist Colin Seal. The protest follows a failed attempt to have it listed. The shelter is now barricaded with building materials clearly visible behind it. Rob Emery, 55, said, "This is a 1950s bus shelter in Art Deco style. We think there are only about 4 of this bus shelter in the country. This one is in good condition. It is right on the edge of a conservation area." When asked why there were already builders at the bus shelter on Monday night, a spokesperson for Norfolk County Council said, "An application made to list the shelter was rejected by Historic England, and we are continuing with our work programme to carry out improvements in the area." The current bus shelter does not meet modern accessibility standards and is unsafe due to its close proximity to the edge of the pavement, creating a pinch point which forces bus users and passing pedestrians into the carriageway. The Town Council are also working with local artist Colin Seal to develop new vinyl artwork for the glass panels in collaboration with local school children.
2 RNLI volunteers have become the first women at their station to qualify in key operational roles. Emma Tark and Fiona Abbs, based at Cromer RNLI, have reached new milestones in their volunteering careers, building on 8 years and 5 years of service respectively. Ms. Tark has now qualified as a winch operator, making her the first female volunteer at Cromer RNLI to serve as launch authority, head launcher, tractor driver and winch operator. As launch authority, she helps decide whether to launch by working with Humber Coast Guard and the coxswain, or helm, to assess conditions and crew readiness. She also oversees launch and recovery operations as head launcher and, through her tractor driver and winch operator roles, supports launches and recoveries in all weather. Miss Abbs, who has volunteered at Cromer RNLI for more than 5 years, has qualified as a head launcher alongside her role as inshore lifeboat crew. She is now the first female volunteer at the station to hold both positions. Cromer RNLI coxswain Paul Watling said both women continue a long tradition of female life-saving. Mr. Watling said, "Women have played a vital role in the RNLI for generations. From early life-saving heroes like Grace Darling to the volunteers, lifeguards and fundraisers of today."
North Norfolk has been named among the best places for a winter staycation. The Telegraph recently published an article highlighting some UK hotspots which are just as magical to visit in winter, especially when the crowds have gone. North Norfolk was one of the locations spotlighted. "Visit North Norfolk in winter and you'll hit the jackpot," the article continued. "And we don't mean the amusement arcade sort, though you can do that in Hunstanton and Cromer if you like. No, you'll avoid summer's crowds, but arguably still see it at its best." It suggested going for a stroll on the long golden beaches while they're empty and searching for seal pups and rare migrating birds. The Telegraph recommended using the Coast Hopper bus to explore different locations and catching a boat out to Blakeney Point, the home of England's largest seal colony.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please, remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Richard Wilson, and editing and producing this issue was Astrid Welfare.
Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio!